stories for you. We'll hear about an August 6th climate rally that youth are organizing in Albany. And we'll also hear about the Poor People's Campaign against voter suppression and for an increased minimum wage, plus the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. And in the second hour, artist August Black will be here live in the WGXC Acres studio, debuting his Mezcal software and taking over the radio for an hour on 90.7 FM. Stay tuned. It all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show.
This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. The stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. The stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network.
WGXE always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need and it is either a Macintosh 2011 or newer, 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer, 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how do I's into here's how you can's. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Fridman Gallery in New York, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant.
This is Tom Rowe. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Pete DeMola and Lauren Stanforth report in the Times Union that last week Greene was the only local county to have so many COVID-19 cases to reach the CDC level recommending indoor mask use. Now, Columbia, Albany, Rensselaer, and Schoharie counties are added to that list. Most local counties now have reached the, quote, substantial, unquote, level of community spread that requires wearing masks indoors again as the Delta variant of COVID-19 is much more contagious and dangerous. The CDC now says, quote, to maximize protection from the Delta variant and prevent possibly spreading it to others, wear a mask indoors in public if you are in an area of substantial or high transmission, unquote. Local officials say that everyone getting vaccinated is the only way out of the pandemic. Quote, data continues to show vaccination decreases the risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death, unquote. Albany County Public Health Commissioner Dr. Elizabeth Whalen said, quote, we encourage people to follow the CDC guidelines and we will continue to evaluate the data and respond appropriately, unquote. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Chloe Callahan reports in the Times Union on July 26, Governor Andrew Cuomo identified two Greene County zip codes with COVID-19 vaccination rates below the statewide average and new positive cases per capita above the statewide average. The zip codes are 12058 for Earlton and 12083 for Greenville. Cuomo also mentioned 12540 for LaGrangeville in Dutchess County and three zip codes in Orange County. Callahan wrote, and I quote, "The level of transmission in Greene County over the past 7 days is now so high, 59 cases out of 100,000 as of Wednesday, the highest of any place in New York outside of the Bronx, that the county health department asked residents on its Facebook page on July 28th to begin wearing masks indoors, whether vaccinated or not," end quote. Cuomo also announced a $15 million allocated towards a targeted vaccination campaign on July 26th, but Greene County Public Administrator Sean Grodin said he did not know anything about that. So Cuomo announced he is targeting certain zip codes to get more vaccinations, but local officials do not know about any specific plans to get any more vaccinations. Instead, Greene County is starting their own Why Not campaign to increase vaccinations. Grodin said, and I quote, "We get vaccinated as children for the measles and more. No one complains about that. Schools have mandates for that," end quote. In Greene County right now, pharmacies are the only places to get vaccinated, as county health officials are not holding any vaccine clinics. Read more about this story in the Times Union.
Sam Rawlins is reporting for Columbia Green Media that the creation of new businesses in Greene County is on the rise, growing by nearly 18% from 2019 to 2020, according to a study by the Center for Economic Growth. In the eight-county capital region last year, 9,465 business formation applications were submitted to the Internal Revenue Service, a 3.2% increase over the previous year. Greene and Schenectady counties led the region in growth. The study defines a business as corporations, partnerships, nonprofits, and sole proprietorships. Greene County Chamber of Commerce President Jeffrey Friedman said the county has seen a large number of businesses start up in the last few years, spanning many types of industries. Quote, "We've had lots of new restaurants, some new manufacturing businesses, and new art-related and creative economy businesses. It has been a wide array of businesses across numerous industries," unquote, Friedman said. He said the growth could be a factor of a few conditions, people discovering Greene County as they leave more heavily populated areas, the availability of storefronts and commercial real estate, and the efforts of the chamber to promote the area. Greene County sales tax collection from January to May 2021 exceeded $15 million, an increase of more than $3 million over the first 5 months of 2020, according to a report from the Office of the State Comptroller. Greene County's sales tax rate is 8%. Half goes to the state and the other half to the county. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Aaliyah Schneider reports for Columbia Green Media that a group of Hudson residents have formed a nonprofit organization to spruce up Hudson's public square. The city park is Hudson's centerpiece, the site of rallies, protests, and where many parades begin. Friends of the public square Hudson want to collaborate with the city and its citizens on park projects. Co-chair Catherine Kananga said, and I quote, "This group of people really is, I would say, newly formed and newly energized. We've also sought to build a board that is diverse and representative of the community. We've been reaching out to different groups like Operation Unite in addition, so we want to make sure that we reach out to all parts of the community," end quote. The group would like to get the fountain working, paint benches a more attractive color, and or replace them, prune trees in poor condition, and mulch and plant bulbs in the public square that is 7th Street and Warren Street. But the Historic Preservation Committee must sign off on any changes to the park. Superintendent of Public Works Robert Perry said, and I quote, "Four people can't just show up at the park and determine what's right for the entire city. All I told them was what the department is capable of doing. Whether or not that will happen, that remains to be seen," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com.
Amelia Teasdale is reporting for the Columbia paper that representatives of National Grid were in attendance at the in-person Kinderhook Village Board meeting on July 14th to explain the utility's plans for electric power transformer bank recently installed on a pole on Hudson Street, as well as upgrading the voltage in some parts of the village. More than half of the people at the meeting were impacted by the platform-mounted transformer bank that was attached on poles located in front of the home of former U.S. Representative Chris Gibson and Mary Gibson. The Gibsons were present at the board meeting. National Grid's Hudson engineer, Serena Hazard, along with two other company representatives, explained the reason for the large transformer platform in its current location and the plan to have it eventually moved. They said the company will add more transformers further down Hudson Street just outside the village, spoke about upgrading the primary voltage in the village and making all the feeders in the village the same voltage class. Hazard explained that the work needed has been made a priority. Chris Gibson requested Hazard provide a letter assuring him that the transformer is being moved and explaining her logic. He explained that he was asking for a letter from the representatives present at the meeting, saying that he would take the issue as high as it needs to go. He said the residents of Kinderhook have not been, quote, communicated to, unquote, said they want to get a place of trust with the corporation. Other residents noted that National Grid had turned up to do work and never notified the community, including the village board. Hazard stressed several times that the project was about reliability and better service. If the transformer on Hudson Street is taken out now, it will mean that when there is an outage, it will take longer for service to come back on some streets in the village, she said. After the National Grid representatives left the meeting, the board voted to approve the option to move the transformer bank on Hudson and Kinderhook Streets to a location outside the village. Read more about this story in the Columbia paper.
Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics. A fourth grade class at Cooperstown Elementary School near the Baseball Hall of Fame proposed making baseball New York's official sport. On July 30th, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed legislation to make their dream a reality. Cuomo said, and I quote, "Growing up a Queens boy, a love of baseball is instilled at an early age. From the 69 and the 86 amazing Mets to 27 world championships by the Yankees and even having been the home of the Dodgers with Jackie Robinson and the Giants, New York is steeped in an expansive and diverse path with our great national pastime. The fervor for the sport is as reflective of our great state as a sport can be, bringing together diverse crowds for the love of the game. New York is the birthplace of baseball, and I'm proud to finally make it our official state sport." End quote. New York has a long history with baseball and many minor league teams, Negro League clubs, and the first documented Grand Slam hit in Troy. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics.
And the Daily Freeman is reporting that the only winning ticket in the Take 5 lottery drawing on July 31st, worth almost $45,000, was sold at a convenience store in Claverick, according to the New York Lottery Division. The winning ticket was purchased at the Extra Mart shop at the intersections of Route 9H and 23. The ticket matched all five numbers drawn, 5, 20, 21, 22, and 30, to win the jackpot of $44,971.50. The odds of matching all five numbers picked are 575,757-1. New York lottery prizes can be claimed for up to 1 year from the date of drawing. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a mostly sunny Monday with a high near 72 and a low around 51. And Tuesday, increasing clouds are likely that it'll still be sunny with a high of 75 and a low around 56. And then Wednesday should be partly sunny with a high near 75 and a low around 56. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, radio for open ears. You have tuned into all sorts of creative community songs, stories, and sounds today on the radio, Monday, August 2nd, including at 11 a.m. We go live to Hudson, where on Playing Favorites, Brendan Donegan celebrates Jamaican Independence Day from the Hudson studio. Then, after the local news, it's time for the Deep Three show, followed at 2 p.m. by an audio buffet with August Black live from Wave Farm with Steve Bradley of the Bells, Bugs, Whispers, and Plinks show. At 4 p.m., we go live to Western Massachusetts, where Kieran Riley hosts the WGXC afternoon show. Then at 7 p.m., it's time for the Law and Disorder show with Michael Ratner, Heidi Bohausen, and Michael Stephen Smith, three progressive lawyers talking about the latest national issues on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM.
Get a local event mentioned on All Together Now. Go to WGXC.org and click on Add an Event at the top of the page. And copy and paste the information about your event in the boxes. Let's all get involved in our community. See what's going on at WGXC.org in the community calendar.
One way to help your local community is to donate blood. And the Red Cross always is looking for donations, including specifically on Thursday, August 12th. There are donations set up in Hudson and Copaic Falls. In Copaic Falls, you can go to Our Lady of Hope Church from 1 to 6 p.m. Thursday, August 12th to donate blood. And in Hudson, you can go to the Hudson Elks Lodge 787. That's at 201 Harry Howard Avenue. Again, from 1 to 6 p.m. Thursday, August 12th at both locations. Go to the WGXC community calendar online to find out many more ways to get involved and help your community, or just go out and entertain yourself through the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need, and it's either a Macintosh 2011 or newer 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info at wgxc.org for more information.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, August 2nd. 58.6% of the way through the year, 51 days left until fall. A little muggy out there early this morning, temperature and dew points at 58 degrees. Any places with a very calm wind might see some fog. Leftover rain cells disappear after 8 a.m. A high of 78 happens at 3 p.m. and cloud cover will diminish as the day goes on. Overnight temperatures fall back to the mid-50s again. Tomorrow, look at that, another dry day. High of 80, little cloudy in the afternoon. Wednesday's looking pretty good too, with a high of about 300 kelvins. That's about 80 degrees. Thursday, I see rain on the horizon, so we'll just drop it there. Pollen levels for today will be low. Over on the river, low tide will be at 5:44 a.m. High tide will be at 11:09 a.m. Low tide will be at 5:37 a.m. and high tide will be at 11:35 p.m. Those times are local for Hudson. Today's river temperature will be 72 degrees. That little bit of a slide is your cue to enjoy what's left of summer while you can. Sunset today will be at 8:01 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:46 a.m. Looking way up, we see another CME erupted from the corpse of an old sunspot. This one is not heading at us, it's just a plasma ball of fun. Solar wind speed is currently 386.3 kilometers per second at 9.2 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair, and they've just creeped up into that territory. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 1, quiet. The current sunspot number is 0. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Maker Syndicate.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Richard Goldstein of Lafayette Hill, Pennsylvania. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
Just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man.
But Hello, and welcome to Backtracks in Time. I'm Jack Sensabaugh, and first I would just like to say this is going to be really a welcome back. I know I've been doing some short abbreviated editions of the show on my own. This is my first show back in the studio since the end of February 2020. I know it's been a long time. I hope everybody is doing well and that we get things back in order here, back on track. Yeah, I had to get it out of the way first. First corny joke after all these months. You're not going to escape it. So again, please welcome back to everyone. Hope everyone is doing well. My subject today will be the Hudson Athens Lighthouse, a very well-known local landmark that needs some work done. A major project needs to be done, and we'll be talking to our guest about that, along with the history of the lighthouse. And my guest is Bob Taylor, a volunteer with the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society. That's a mouthful. So welcome, Bob.
Thank you.
And so, to start off, first of all, how did you get involved with the society?
Well, it was actually an evolution over time. I started out about 25 years ago deciding with my photography, instead of nice white New England churches and covered bridges, I got fascinated with lighthouses. Well, before you know it, I found out you could buy models of lighthouses. Then you could turn around and join group societies, and I've done that quite a few around the country. And then on top of that, these societies actually organize trips, so I started signing up for those because I realized on a trip, they'll get a lighthouse open where you as an individual go up and look at the locked door, and I've done that many a time. So it was sort of an evolution over time. And as time went on, I began to notice I would go to a lighthouse and there would be people there, even Coast Guard people in uniform. And they would say, well, I'm just volunteering today. And I'm thinking like, oh, I'm just sponging, getting in on the volunteers here. This is awful. So after a few years, I began to feel guilty. So I said, well, if I was going to make a contribution, I certainly wouldn't do that in Maine. Well, that's a nice place. It would take me a day to drive up and a day to drive back. So I looked around, and at that point, much to my amazement, there were lighthouses in the Hudson River. And I said, my goodness, my parents used to take me shopping over in Albany when we were kids, because they had a much bigger selection of stores and things, and it was easy to fit three different people, three different sizes. So I looked around, and the northernmost one that's still there today is the Hudson Athens. So then I literally checked them out, and I found them. And this was really before the internet was what it is today, but I did find that they were over there. And I went over and I sat in the parking lot and I waited and waited. And finally, I saw this pontoon boat that said Lighthouse Lady on it. And I said, that looks pretty good. So I got talking to the folks. And next thing you know, I'm joining up. And then I became a life member. So now I don't feel guilty anymore.
Right. I that's great how that worked out. I got to tell the folks, I saw Bob a couple of weeks ago, not to be introduced, but I took my first tour of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse about 2 weeks ago, and I've lived in this area for 51 years, all my life. First time I've been to that lighthouse, so it was wonderful that they do some good work there. So, a little history now, into a little history of the house itself. So why was it built? When was it built?
Yes, well, you know, it's funny, when I talk about lighthouses, and I actually do slide presentations at different places, And when I say, well, I volunteer at the Hudson Athens, and people look at me and say, where's that? Well, I said, it's in the middle of the Hudson River. And they look at me like, oh, no, this sounds wrong. But what happened is, if you go back and look at this thing historically, there was a great age of exploration. Today it's space, but in those days it was trying to get from Europe over to India and Asia and Asia Minor to trade and make all kinds of money. Now, the putting the spices and things on camels and taking them over the desert was not the best way. So back in the 1800s, they started exploring, and they were going down the west coast of Africa to see if they could round the corner and get over to China and India. And the same thing in this area. Now, Henry Hudson, who they named the river after, he was thinking, well, wait a minute now, if this is a globe we're on, why don't I just sail west and I can go right around the circle and come out and hit India and China? This is going to be great. Well, guess what he hit? What we would call New York Harbor today. And up the Hudson River he went. 1604. And he got up there, and he's lucky he got his boat turned around and got back out without hanging it up, because it obviously got worse the farther north he went. The water was shallower. The width of the river was narrower. So anyway, he went back sort of not too happy with his thoughts, but his thinking was okay. So anyway, if you think about this country and the way we developed, really we developed along the East Coast, Maine, New Hampshire, Virginia, places like that. So if you're going to expand, how would you expand? Well, back in the, say, 1800s, there, and particularly the early, there was no railroad. There was no roads or anything like that. If you wanted to go west, it was very difficult to do. So some enterprising folks thought about, hey, you know what? If we can take early 1800s now, this became the canal building era. Mm-hmm. We can build a canal from Buffalo all the way over to Albany, Troy, ended up in Waterford. Then we could go up the Hudson River and we could go across. And of course, everybody thought, well, this is a government, you know, boondoggle coming down the road. But when they got it open, it was like, oh my goodness, how can I use this to increase my trade if you were a trader in things? Now, they opened that up in 1825. So if you look at the lighthouses on the Hudson River, it was in the 1800s when they started putting them all in. The same as California got them all once they discovered gold in Alaska. It was like, wow.
If big, I want to be there.
Big building program, yeah. So that's what actually happened. Now, it's the same thing as on any kind of road you build around town. The more traffic you put on it, the more mishaps. And eventually put stop signs. You eventually put stop lights. And then eventually you put radar and all kinds of things. So the same was true with the Hudson River. If you were sailing up and down the river, particularly the dayliners, those were great big steam-operated boats. And if you're going up the river and trying to make record time, New York to Albany, you might be a little careless, particularly after dark and things like that. So they would have mishaps. And one of the mishaps that sort of put Hudson and Athens on their map was this big boat, 250 passengers roughly. You had a berth down below if you wanted to sleep on the trip. That could have been deadly. But anyway, this thing was flying up the river, and it hit a sandbar just north of the present lighthouse. Now, when you look at the sandbar today, it's not a sandbar, but it's an island. I'll get to that in a moment. But what happened was that boat in November, now I imagine the water's nice and warm in November.
Oh, yeah.
That boat went up on the sandbar and it cracked. Now, you never want a wooden boat to crack. I don't think you want an aluminum boat to crack. That was bad. Well, people got dumped out. So what they did is they came over in boats to try to rescue people. And they figure there are probably 245 people on the board, but they actually don't know because they don't have the manifest list that they have today on the airlines. They know exactly who and what seat, you know, kind of thing. So they estimate 10 to 25 people died from drowning, didn't make it out safely. But that's just a guesstimate. It could be lower, it could be higher. So, of course, then they do what they do today. You have to petition Congress to get an appropriation to build a lighthouse. Now, very few have been built in recent years. But anyway, that's what brought that all about. Now, that was 1845. They didn't get it built and opened till November of 1874, almost 30 years later. And there were other lighthouses also being built up and down the Hudson River. So that's how it all came about. Safety. And you don't necessarily think of lighthouses as safety. You know, you think of it as a tourist attraction, it'll bring in tourists, maybe we can sell souvenirs and make money, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But actually, these were all run by the Coast Guard initially. Well, actually, initially by the U.S. Lighthouse Service, and then they were turned over to the Coast Guard in 1939. And they're really designed for safe navigation.
Okay. The water's going to be a little treacherous.
Yeah. Well, they said they were losing a ship a day that is on the high seas around the world. Remember,
really?
Now, they were out on the ocean for a year or two at a time trying to kill whales and boil down the blubber.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there was a lot of stuff going on in the water.
Now, is there anything unusual, the architecture of this house?
Well, the architecture really is, it's got master roofs on the sides, on the second story. So the first floor is four rooms, and it's brick, and they're all straight walls. The second floor, the walls tip in, and they're covered with slate. And then the roof is just a rubber membrane that they put on school buildings and that kind of stuff today. But there is one, Stepping Stones, down in New York Harbor that is somewhat similar in construction and looks. But it's sort of an odd one. But when you look at lighthouses, in many ways, they're odd because they built them out of local materials. I mean, the day was gone. There was no day, rather, in that day to run out to the local hardware store and everybody could buy the same color paint and the same kind of wood and stuff. I mean, they literally, so around here, it's not surprising that they had limestone blocks. And if you walk down by the train station, you still see them mining stone, crushing it up to small stone that I guess they use for road base, for the base for roads and stuff. So that's still going on today. So it's not surprising that we're displaying it out there. And the bricks found kilns that baked bricks were very common because you couldn't ship stuff for all practical purposes. You know, you couldn't ship the stuff out to Ohio. So you had to find something there and use local material, which is why an awful lot of ones were built out of wood, and over the years, they didn't last.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense.
They were replaced,
Subject to the storms and everything out in the middle of the water. Now, I know the families ran the lights, I guess you could say. And I know most well-known family of this lighthouse was the Brunners. Were there other ones before then?
Oh, yes, right. Well, it started back in 84. When they built the thing, they assumed it was going to be a family operation.
Okay.
So that's why we ended up with four rooms down and four rooms up. In some ways, it wasn't a bad deal because if you're a lighthouse keeper, you got a monthly check. That's good. Very good. And the other thing is they would bring you, for example, if you needed to paint the walls, they would bring you the paint and you would store it. They would bring you, for the Hudson Athens, 11 tons of coal, and they would go down into a coal bin in the cellar, and that basically would not only heat the building for 12 months, but it also, even on a hot summer's day, you'd have a fire because you might be baking bread. You couldn't run out to the mom-and-pop store and buy bread. You know, you were really limited. So the assumption was there was going to be a family there. And over the years, there was a number of families that lived there. What would happen is, which is kind of unusual, the husband sometimes would die first. And the wife realized that she was sort of the assistant keeper, but not on the payroll. And she realized that it would make sense for her to keep this thing going because by the time they found out in Washington, they had no complaints, so she could get the job and the income. So that's how the gals often became lighthouse keepers when their husband could no longer do it. And even if he was just laid up for a month or two, you know, you were sure everything was taken care of.
Right, it still had to be done.
Yeah, now that was in the day before we had unions and collective bargaining and OSHA and a whole variety of things.
Yeah.
So that it was a seven-day week job. And that went initially until the river froze over. But once the river froze over, then the ice, the lighthouse keeper was free to do what he wanted to. And many of them actually, in this area, would go down on the Hudson River and get a job cutting ice because they would cut ice. And I've seen black and white photos of this. They'd have conveyor belts, so they would go, blocks of ice would go up the conveyor belt. They'd put them in barns, pack them in sawdust. And then in the summer, they'd put it on a boat, take it to New York City, and that became what we call refrigeration. Right. And you hear people refer to the old ice box. That's where that came from. It was a hunk of ice in your insulated box, and that became your refrigerator, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Now, the Brunners actually came here in 1930, And somebody had the foresight years ago to put Emily, who lived there as a child from 1930 to 36, on the park bench in Athens and just let her tell one story after another. And they recorded them. So though Emily left us in 2017, we have her in video, in color, and we have in the lighthouse, actually, a couple of flat-screen TVs where we can show that to people that come out, particularly people that don't want to climb up a whole bunch of stairs to get there and stuff. So it works out. So from 30 to 36, that was the last family to actually occupy the building. So time came to look at restoring it. People said, why don't we restore it to 1930 to 36 time frame?
Okay.
So because that's when it was that. So after that, what happened is in 1930, the family bought a house in Athens.
Okay.
And the family moved to Athens, but Emil, the lighthouse keeper, he still stayed there. So he stayed at the lighthouse from 1936 to 49 when he retired. And when, but of course, I would expect on the weather we've been having these last couple of weeks, you know, you get a rainy spell. I probably say, you know, he probably said to his wife about 5 o'clock after supper, I'm going out to the lighthouse. I'm going to stay there for the night. We'll see you in the morning if the sun is shining, you know. And because why roll back and forth and get soaking wet, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But what you don't realize is those lighthouses had kerosene lamps for illumination, not only for the light, but if you wanted to fill out government reports at your desk, you had a kerosene lamp. So there was a great big tank out there. Now, in the house, they have about 275. So this was probably maybe a 5,000-gallon or 2,000-gallon, something like that, tank.
Yeah.
And then they stored the stuff. So anyway, when it came time in 1939, Franklin Delano Roosevelt down the road here, he decided that the U.S. Lighthouse Service was going to come underneath the U.S. Coast Guard. So everybody automatically got changed to that payroll. And at the time, you were a civilian employed by the government, so that you had a choice. You could join the Coast Guard, you could quit, or you could remain a civilian as long as you did the job up to Coast Guard standards. So Emma was one of those that actually joined the Coast Guard and retired from the Coast Guard.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize he had done that. Yeah, I knew the Coast Guard was taking it over, but I never thought about him joining the Coast Guard. See, so I love doing the show. All these little things. Okay, folks. Well, we're just about at the end of our first segment here. You recall the show is done in segments now. And so please stay tuned, and we're back with more with Bob Taylor and from the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society in segment two. Thank you.
Hello, this is Rob Gellis with This Month in History, a chronicle of significant or infamous events in art, science, music, literature, sports, and more that occurred this month either in the near or distant past. On August 1st, 1839, slavery was abolished on the island of Jamaica. On August 3rd, 1492, Christopher Columbus set sail from Spain with three ships, the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria, looking for a westerly route to the Orient. On August 5th, 1861, President Abraham Lincoln signed into law the first federal income tax as an emergency measure during the Civil War. However, the tax was never put into effect. On August 9, 1974, Richard M. Nixon resigned the presidency as the result of the Watergate break-in. Nixon became the only U.S. president to ever resign. On August 12, 1881, film director Cecil B. DeMille was born in Ashfield, Massachusetts. His films included The Ten Commandments and The Greatest Show on Earth. On August 14, 1935, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act. It guarantees pensions to those who retire and also provides financial aid to dependent children and those who have disabilities. On August 17, 1786, Davy Crockett was born in Tennessee. He was a scout and served as a congressman. He perished during the defense of the Alamo in Texas. On August 24, 79 AD, the volcano Mount Vesuvius erupted and destroyed the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum in southern Italy. On August 27, 1910, Mother Teresa was born in the former country of Yugoslavia. She founded a religious order of nuns in Calcutta, India. She spent her life working to help the poor and sick of India. On August 31, 1786, the Shays Rebellion began in western Massachusetts. It was led by ex-Revolutionary War Captain Daniel Shays. It was put down in early 1787. Shays was sentenced to death but was pardoned in 1788. You've been listening to This Month in History, a monthly broadcast of historic events on WGXC 90.7 FM. If you have an event that you'd like to hear included in This Month in History, email me, Rob Gellis, at info@wgxc.org.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking with Miriam Ellerberg, who's one of the coordinators, organizers of the New York Youth Climate Leaders. And they are holding a climate rally at the state capitol this Friday, August 6th. At 1:30. Miriam, can you maybe just give us a little background? What is the New York Youth Climate Leaders and why did you decide to hold this rally?
Of course. So the New York Youth Climate Leaders is a statewide organization of youth leading, working on environmental and economic justice here in New York. Specifically, we are policy driven. So we work mostly on the legislative side of environmental activism here in New York. And we decided to do a rally in the Capitol on August 6th because of the lack of action that the legislature has taken in recent years on climate, and specifically to advocate for the divestment of the New York State Teachers Retirement System from investments in fossil fuels.
Now, I know that both New York City and New York State pension funds have moved towards divestment. I guess New York City's actually done part of it, as has the New York State. But why wasn't the Teachers Retirement Fund included as part of the decision by Tom DiNapoli, state controller, to divest? And how do your teachers react to this idea that their pensions are being invested in fossil fuels?
So the Teachers Retirement Fund was not included under Tom DiNapoli's agreement to divest because it is not one of the state-controlled funds. It is controlled by a board of trustees. Our teachers, all of the ones that I've spoken to at my school, have generally been shocked that their retirement fund is invested in fossil fuels, considering that they teach us about climate change and how to prepare for our future. And they also have understood that fossil fuels really aren't a great investment for any of them that have looked into the stock market.
So what has been the reaction of the Board of Trustees of the Teachers Retirement Fund when you come in and say, hey, the state, cities have done it. In fact, fossil fuels are both losing money now and going to be losing money in the future. Plus, you know, why are we investing in the destruction of the planet with climate change and fossil fuels? What is the pension fund's reaction to these type of concerns?
Pension fund has been very slow moving on the concerns that we've raised about their investments in fossil fuels. They frequently have been saying that they will divest from fossil fuels as the stock market shifts, but fail to realize that they have the power to shift the stock market. And their investments in fossil fuels are hurting their portfolio more than they're benefiting them. So it's a very flawed reasoning to say that they will wait for the market to shift, but they have been pushing off divestment.
Now, the issue of trying to get the teachers funded investment in fossil fuel is perhaps a central part of the rally, but you're also concerned about other issues that the state legislature, the state lawmakers, the governor has failed to take action on climate. What are some of the other issues that the New York youth climate leaders are promoting?
Yeah, so throughout this past legislative session, we've worked on bills such as the Clean Futures Act, which would ban the building of new fossil fuel power plants, as well as the ending of fossil fuel subsidies in New York State budget. And also in the budget, we have advocated for taxing the rich in a more progressive structure to benefit New Yorkers and invest in necessary services, especially considering the budget deficit the pandemic has caused.
Yeah, I'll just mention for some of our listeners, there is a Clean Futures Act at the state level, which, you know, goes about trying to stop new power plants from using fossil fuels. Unfortunately, there's a similar name bill at the federal level that Congressman Paul Tonko has been doing, that people in the Capitol District have been demonstrating against, because it supports a lot of close climate solutions. But there are actually different bills, one at the state and one at the federal level. So what will happen at the rally on Friday, August 6th at the state capitol at 1:30?
We plan on gathering lots of youth and other activists from across the state here in Albany and West Capitol Park, and having various speakers from environmental and activism organizations speak on the necessity of climate action and the need for urgent action, as well as a little bit of an art exhibition about the need to divest and what that means to students and teachers.
So, why should students join the New York Youth Climate Leaders, and what's been the reaction to your fellow students, from the work that you all are doing?
My fellow New York students from across the state have been very supportive when they hear about our organization. Definitely interested in fighting against climate change, just because of how relevant it is to our lives as young people. And those with the ability definitely help out in our organizing when they can.
And if people want more information about New York Youth Climate Leaders, I imagine you have various social media outlets that people can go visit.
Yeah, we are on Instagram at NY2CL. And I believe our Twitter is at NY Youth Leaders or NY Youth Climate Leaders. I believe we're on Facebook at NY Youth Climate Leaders. And I believe that is our social medias. Our website is NY2CL.org.
Now, as you know, New York Youth Climate Leaders, you know, relatively young people, obviously, perhaps, you know, what has been your or the organization's perception as you have worked on climate change about, how quickly us adults are moving on this issue and how quickly, you know, our elected officials are responding to this issue?
Yeah, there's definitely been a mix of responses from adults in the urgency that with which they view climate change. There have been plenty of other adult activists and even some members of the legislature who acknowledge that immediate action is necessary at the correct level. But there have also been many who, while they agree with the need for climate action, have put it more on a back burner, which is very distressing to watch as a young person.
So I do understand that you have buses coming from Western New York and New York City. If people in the Capital District want to get involved in helping out with Friday's event, how best can they do that?
Well, we will be gathering in West Capitol Park at 1:30. That's when things will kick off. So just gathering there, and it'll only be for about an hour and a half.
Okay. And in the last 45 seconds, are there other things after the rally that the group intends to follow up with?
Yeah, we intend to continue lobbying for passage of environmental bills, as well as educating youth from across the state about different ways to achieve economic and environmental justice here in New York.
Okay. So we've been talking with Miriam Ellerberg, who's with the New York Youth Climate Leaders, and they'll be having a rally about climate change and the teacher pension fund getting invested in fossil fuel this Friday, August 6th, West Capitol Park at 1:30. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And I'm Tom Rowe here live in Acre, and we're about to leave the WGXC Morning Show for a special audio buffet with artist in residence August Black here at Wave Farm. He will present live Footsteps as Radio Sculpture. Custom cell phone footwear gives a parabolic shape to near-ground recordings as Black walks around Wave Farm. That's next. Stay tuned. It starts in seconds.
Right.